But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm here with co-host, as usual, Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. How art thou?
That was good. I'm real good this morning, you know. It's just, spring has sprung. I got to play golf last week, so it's all looking up, you know. And I went to, thank you for that. And I went to, I was in Boston this week.
Really? When did you go up?
I left Tuesday and came back Wednesday. I just went for one night. I went for dinner. And there's a place up there that I ate for the first time about a year ago called Sorrelina, which is kind of a modern Italian restaurant. You know, it's not like your, you know, red checker tablecloths or anything like that. It looks more like almost like a steakhouse, but leans Italian, you know, a lot of nice pastas and things like that. And so I got taken out to dinner for my birthday.
Very nice.
Yes. And it was a lot of fun. We had, we got up there a little late. You know, we were running a little late for the ferry. I mean, not terribly, because I take the ferry out of Orient Point, you know, and it drops you into London. I like that better than driving around. I don't have to drive as much. But
still, a little bit of a trip to go out east.
Well, I was out there anyway. I was out in Jamesport. But the funny part is, as would always happen with me, I get behind a guy who's doing like 7 miles an hour under the speed limit, you know, and it's a one lane road out there, and you can't. And I'm like flicking the lights, you know. You think you just get out of the way. If you want to crawl, crawl, fine. Just let everybody else go, you know.
Right.
Can't pass. It's a double yellow line, and of course I get there, and you know we missed the ferry by like 2 minutes or whatever. Right. So I got to sit in the parking lot for an hour. So I got up to Boston around 3:30 or something like that. Reservation was at 6:45 and, you know, whatever. So anyway, we had dinner. A couple of things I got to say. One is, I'm a wine fan, as everybody knows by now. And, sometimes there are wines on the list that, you know, people find, and me too. I mean, everybody has a limit, you know, about what they want to spend on a glass of wine or a bottle of wine. And I think I've said this before, and I think that when people go to restaurants, they have a certain comfort level with what they want to spend. And when they go above that comfort level, that's when all the whining begins, because I think the expectation level goes up exponentially with the added anxiety of the fact that you're going over your limit or budget or whatever you want to call it. I'm kind of, everybody's like that. I mean, I have a number for a house. I have a number for a car. I have, numbers that you're comfortable with, right? I don't have a number in restaurants, largely because I can probably write some of it off A and B. You know, it's my business and it's always research and development. So I get there and I'm looking at the wine list. And I'm thinking, okay, I'll have a glass of white and then we'll, figure it out. And they had a wine on it. Angelo Gaia is a big deal in northern Italy, Piedmont. He makes a lot of Barolos and Barbarescos, and he's like the Robert Mondavi or whatever of northern Italy. And his wines are very expensive. In 1985, somebody brought me a bottle of his Chardonnay. It was the first time he ever made Chardonnay, and I was thinking, yeah, okay, Gaia's got a big reputation, but Italian Chardonnays I've never been knocked out by, right? So I was with my partner, Marty, at the time, and we opened up this bottle of wine. It was called Gaia E. Ray, R-E-Y. And, take a sip, and I'm like, oh, my God. Is that it? Really? And I had another sip, and it just kept getting better and better, and it was one of the best Chardonnays I ever had in my life, which is saying something, because I've had 10,000 of them, right? So I hadn't bought it or seen it since, 1985. Or 80, I guess 86 when we had it. So it's on the menu for by the glass, and they had, the regular glass lists, like the usual suspects of Pinot Grigio, Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, whatever. But they had a Coravin selection. Now, for those of you who don't know what a Coravin is a little like device that allows you to draw wine from the bottle without taking the cork out. There's a needle on there. and there's a canister of nitrogen canister. So what happens when you put the needle through the cork, you can pour out the wine through that, and the wine is replaced by the nitrogen tank. So it seals the wine up, and CO2 cartridge, not nitrogen, CO2 cartridge. It drives the wine out of there, and you pull the needle out, and the cork, you know, kind of springs back into place and keeps the thing sealed. So you can serve bigger wines by the glass without opening the bottle and risking that the thing is going to go bad, right? So they have this Corvin section. And they had two Chardonnays in the Corvin section. They had the Gaia, a 22 Gaia, and they had, I think, a 21 Knights Valley. I think it was a Knights Valley or Paul Hobbs or whatever. Anyway, so I'm like, oh, wow, I haven't had a Gaia Chardonnay in a long time, you know? So Valerie says, well, look, it's only $72 a bottle. That's a glass. You know, she goes, you kidding me? I'm like, no, it's a glass, not a bottle. Oh, my God, I didn't realize, you know. So anyway, I was laughing, and it turns out that, so we had a couple glasses, you know, and it was as good as I remembered. It was, it's a very expensive wine.
Is that probably a $500 bottle
of
wine?
Yeah, it's a $400 or $500 bottle of wine. But it was, you know, and here's the other thing, too. I mean, excuse me, the great part about Corvin is if you're, you know, mentally ill like I am when it comes to wine, you can taste the Gaia Chardonnay without spending $400. It costs you $72, but, you know, that's better than $400, right? So anyway, we had a couple glasses of that. And then we ordered dinner, and you know, dinner was so much fun. They had a Bronzino Crudo there with finger limes finger limes and rhubarb. And you ever see finger limes? They're really interesting little things. They look like a tiny little lime. They're I guess they're about the size of a walnut, maybe. And when you cut them open, you know, there's no flesh like you see in a regular lime. It's all these little pearls, like caviar, almost. And you take them out, and they're a great little garnish. You put them on, and you take, it's like having Pop Rocks in your mouth, only with lime, you know? So anyway, it was really great. And the busboy was cute. He puts the thing down, and some of the lime juice, it was like a square plate with a round indentation, you know? And it had all of, you know, the Bronzino in there. And I guess some of the lime juice spilled out onto the part of the plate that was flat. He says to me, do you want me to take it back and get it repaired? I'm like, I'm good. You know, it's a little lime juice. Relax, you know. I thought it was cute. And then we ordered two pastas. We had a lumache, which is kind of like an elbow-shaped rigatoni with a bolognese sauce that was actually mounted. We used to call it mounted, or it's kind of emulsified with bone marrow butter. Was really, really good.
So bolognese many times can be creamy, or sometimes it's not creamy.
Yeah.
How was yours?
I don't think bolognese needs a lot of cream. I mean, I know a lot of people make it with milk, which doesn't thicken it. Like, it just like maybe calms the acidity down a little bit. I've gone both ways with it. I've made it both ways. I kind of like it without. Only because it's got more beefy flavor, and that's kind of what I'm looking for. So we had that, and then we had this really interesting ravioli that was made with lamb's neck, and people use lamb's neck because it's really inexpensive. So you take it, and you braise it down, you pull the meat off it, obviously, and then stuff the ravioli. It had very, very small pieces of like peppermint in there, you know, like chopped parsley. I think it might even have been a chocolate mint. You know, they have all kinds of different flavored mints now that come out, they grow. But I think it was almost like a chocolate mint. It wasn't really the regular mint flavor, like the spearmint stuff. It was really different and really good. They had a nice little jus underneath. Fabulous. And then we split a halibut, which was kind of seared and perfectly cooked. But it was on this cauliflower puree with Romanesco and cauliflower and a little bit of truffle oil. And it was good. I mean, it was good, but it was kind of plain. And I thought the plate needed like a little color because, you know, you had the white halibut, the white cauliflower, the white puree. It was white. It was, we need a little diversity, damn it, you know. So I think it could have used a little color, but the whole meal was great. And then, you know, somebody let out the fact that it was my birthday, which is mortifying for me, right? And they brought out a nice little, you know, sorbet with the happy birthday on the plate. Thank God nobody sang. And it was great. Then we went back to the bar and had two more glasses of the Gaia Chardonnay just because, you know. And then we had a bottle of I brought a bottle up of 2014 Marie Saint Denis, which is one of my favorite properties in Burgundy. So we killed the night with a little red. It was just a great, I mean, for me, it's the perfect birthday celebration. No singing, whole bunch of food and wine, go to bed.
So let's revisit the Chardonnay. I wouldn't normally think of you as a Chardonnay guy, and actually not so much a white wine guy. Mm-hmm. So Chardonnays can be sometimes very sweet, or
well, I don't think sweet's the right term. I think off dry. Sometimes there was a whole movement in California in the 80s and 90s, and it was started probably by Jess Jackson and Kendall Jackson. And they made these, you know, some people accuse them of putting unfermented juice back in and whatever, but the Chardonnays were a little sweeter. There was some kind of thing going on.
And I probably didn't really mean sweet. I probably meant not as robust or heavy.
I think you were right on with the sweet thing. I think that was correct. And I think, from my opinion, I think they ruined Chardonnay for a lot of people for a long time. I didn't drink Chardonnay for years. I mean, I always drank white Burgundy. That's Chardonnay, but it's different. It's just made differently. The ground's different. The flavors are different. And I do. I drink a fair amount of white wine, probably more than red, unless it's the winter. But, you know, for them to make, I mean, the Chardonnay that Gaia makes in Italy is from Lange, which is up near Piedmont, you know, which you wouldn't think of as a great Chardonnay growing area. You think of Burgundy, you think of California, even Long Island, whatever. But it was nuts. So good.
So as far as white wines, walk me through Chardonnay to a Pinot, even an Italian white.
Well, there's, you know, obviously there's a million varieties and varietals in Italy. I think when you take a grape like Pinot Grigio, it or Sauvignon Blanc, they tend to be thinner, you know.
Yes.
You know, and a little more acidic.
Oh.
You know, which is, and it's not a knock. I mean, it's what they're supposed to be. Just a completely different flavor profile. And you start, like, on the low end of it, Sauvignon Blanc. Sauvignon Blanc or Sancerre, which is basically Sauvignon Blanc, is really acidic, lemony. You know, and then you get those New Zealand ones that have all that pineapple and kiwi, and some people call it cat pee, and, you know, grassiness or whatever. And then you get into the more aromatic things like, you know, Pinot Grigio or Sylvaner and Riesling, grapes like that. And then you can get to the really sweeter, you know, or more herbaceous, you know, Gewurztraminers and things that they make, even some dessert wines out of. Chardonnay, for me, is a completely different animal. And I think that, you know, I think Chardonnay is probably the king of white wine grapes, you know, especially when it's handled at the high end in a place like Burgundy, where they have, you know, older vines and 2,000 years of winemaking under their belt. They really, you know, have a great handle on how to do it. And even those, I mean, they go from, you know, the entry level, lower end, you know, let's just make some wine, to, oh my God, we've been slaving over this for 2,000 years and we finally got it right. And, you know, we finally have the terroir and the grapes are, I mean, the vines are old enough, and they make some spectacular, spectacular Chardonnays in Burgundy. And I think that, to me, that's the place that my heart lies when it comes to Chardonnay. Now, that's not to say they don't make great Chardonnays in other places. I mean, there's great Chardonnay in California. I was lucky enough to go to a vineyard there and where they made Lahota. It's L-A, new word, J-O-T-A, Lahota Chardonnay, which was knee-melting spectacular. I thought it was one of the best Chardonnays I've ever had. And, you know, they're all up and down the coast. I mean, they do a great job. I think Long Island makes some great Chardonnays. But Chardonnays can go, for me, from, like, when you take Chablis, which is Chardonnay, right? And that Chablis is generally fermented in steel barrels, so there's no oak on it. You don't get any of that oaky, you know, kind of all those flavors that the oak imparts. It's just stainless steel, and it's very different from, you know, other white Burgundies. But I think that, you know, for me, you know, people ask me, you know, what are you going to pair Chardonnay with? I like Chardonnay by itself. I just like to, you know, sit there on my knees and bow down, and just when it's a great Chardonnay, I don't want to get food involved.
Sitting out in the summer, you know, just relaxing, it seems like a great...
Oh, listen, with cornflakes, it's great. You know what I mean? It's like, I can eat it with chocolate.
How does Chardonnay go with, like, some of the spicier foods, though? I know you said you're fine with just having a glass of Chardonnay.
Yeah, yeah.
But with a spicy meal...
I wouldn't use Chardonnay.
Really?
I would use Riesling or something that has a little touch more off dryness. Yeah, Rieslings and Sylvaners, the aromatic whites tend to handle like Thai food a lot better than Chardonnay. I think it just gets in the way of the Chardonnay. Chardonnay to me, if you're gonna drink it, it's, you know, I think of lobster, I think of, you know, shellfish, I think of seafood, you know, white sauces, even chicken, you know, light meats. I would even drink it with pork. You know, the other white meat, as they call it. But when you get a great Chardonnay, and I've had a few. I've had a few of those Le Mans Richets and Batards and Chevaliers, and they're just so overwhelmingly good on their own that it's almost sacrilegious to screw around with the, you know, with any kind of food and flavor. But those things, they're becoming untouchable. I mean, I'm looking, you know, at restaurant. You know, I was looking at restaurant prices the other day because I was up in Sorlene in Boston. And, you know, they had a very big Le Mans Richet on there, and it was like $1,700 for a bottle. You know, I'm not that nuts, you know. So, you know, they become almost these cult things that are out there. I mean, I'm lucky enough that I drank all of these wines back when they were somewhat affordable. There was a DRC, which is a Domaine de la Romani Conti, on the menu for $7,800. You got to have a whole bunch of ammunition to be throwing $7,000 at a bottle of wine. You know what I mean? So they've become so precious now that they're almost undrinkable for anybody but, you know, people who have that kind of money. And again, there's value in that, you know, but not if you have $1,000 in your, you know, budget.
So here's an interesting scenario that probably everybody comes across. How many times do you go to a catered affair? And they'll put a bottle of red, a bottle of white on the table.
Yeah.
And again, I don't think they're going to put a $7,000 bottle
of wine. No, of course
not.
You know, it'd be insane. You know.
And also to say that the least expensive wine isn't the best wine being served that night. I get a little snobby because I always get the impression that the house wine is going to be mediocre at best.
Well, listen, I've been an advocate since Panama Hatties, right? I had the first 16-bottle Cruvenet, which is a wine preservation system, right, on Long Island. And, you know, I've been serving premium wines by the glass since 1983. You know, a lot of people have gotten on board since then. And, you know, I'm not blowing my horn. I'm just stating a fact. I mean, a lot of people have gotten on board since then, but it's still, I mean, I still go into restaurants where it's, you know, red, white, and pink, you know, house, house, house. I think, you know, most people realize that, yeah, you can take a $3 bottle of wine, charge $10 a glass or whatever, and you're going to make some money, but are they going to have a second one? I mean, that's the real measure of a wine, you know, is, you know, do they come back for a second glass, whether it's $3 a bottle or $20 a bottle?
Wait, so this is a great story. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a restaurant that had a pretty good reputation. It had a sister restaurant east of there.
You're going to have to tell me off camera here.
And the experience the night I went was absolutely terrible.
Oh, no.
But I was just there for a family party, and they had a buffet Sunday morning. And I can't begin to tell you how on the mark they were. You know, when the steak came out undercooked and cold, they had the steak in a tray and cut up or whatever, and it was delightful. It was tender. Everything was good. You know, they had quiche Lorraine, a couple other, you know, nice service items, but it was delightful as compared to this
disaster
nightmare, yeah, of a night between service and the food. But what I wanted to share was, I look over to my right in the corner of the restaurant. There's a table of maybe six people, and they brought their own wine, and they I guess, had paid for it to be served.
Open, yeah.
And but they had the waitress decant the bottle,
mm-hmm.
which was filled, and then immediately emptied. So I didn't really understand if there was any virtue in that.
Well, you know, you want to decant it. You want to breathe for a little while. You know, like
I'm telling you, it didn't happen. I'm telling you, they opened the bottle, poured it in, and then they were serving the wine.
It seems to me that the host was just a little bit on the pretentious side, and you know, kind of.
That's the way I took it.
Yeah, you know, I have old Bordeaux's home, and I have some from '82, which was a spectacular year, and I have some wines that were rated a perfect 182, 1982, and I'm worried now. It's 40 years, you know, so. I'm going to have to drink this soon because, A, I don't have a lot of time, and B, neither does the wine, you know what I mean, I think. But I just read an article on the specific wine I'm talking about. It said that the guy said, you know, he tasted it, and he says, I think it can go another 10 to 15 years. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, I don't know if I can, but the wine can.
I also got a kick. Again, I'm not from a big drinker, but serving a bottle of wine to six people is just about one service.
Yeah, you get almost a glass of wine apiece.
Right.
Yeah.
So, again, it just drove me nuts, and it shouldn't have even cared. But well, I mean, first decanting the wine, then it was one bottle for six people, yeah. And I'm thinking, like, where do they go next?
Yeah.
And that be said, I'm not a big drinker of wine, but I hang out with people that can put it away,
yeah.
And it's not unusual for two couples to bring to the table two bottles of wine. I mean, the other couple will definitely through it pretty quickly and have a cocktail. And Kerry and I are pretty laid back. But, it's amazing.
So here's another thing that came up. And, you know, getting back to the caterer for a second. I mean, I understand you're not going to put a $30 bottle of wine on a catering table for people unless you're charging for it. I mean, I've had parties where the people upgraded the wine choices because they wanted to, you know. So instead of serving, you know, what would be, I don't have a house wine per se, but instead of serving something that's a little less expensive for me, they said, you know, we want to have, you know, flower Chardonnay, or we want to have, a Bourgogne poured at the, yeah, okay, you know, as long as you're paying for it, who cares, you know. But I think that, you know, some of these people don't understand it, you know. When you have, I think what I'm trying to say is you can miss on the low side just as easily as you can miss on the high side,
sure.
Right? They don't want to like spend a lot of money on the wine. I don't know why. You know, they do it for beer. They do it for, you know, they got Pappy Van Winkle behind the bar. They got all these expensive, you know, Casa Azul or whatever. And meanwhile, you know, now you got Chateau Tuesday, 4 o'clock, you know, that you're giving everybody else. And I'm like, what did you miss here? Why did you stop with the, you know, it's crazy. Craft beers everywhere.
I got to admit, one of the greatest wine experiences I ever had was close family friends were getting married and they wanted to, everybody to leave with a bottle of wine.
Uh-huh.
And I came to you and we did a wine tasting. I don't remember if it was a Cool Fish or maybe that place where you were consulting with in Rockville Center. So, mm-hmm. I mean, this goes back probably about 10, 12 years ago. And you brought out a selection of your wines that you were serving at that location. And they chose, I believe, two or three different wines.
Yeah,
and it was really, really a cool experience.
Yeah.
And I think I got to find out about your private Riesling, which is an incredible wine.
Thank you.
What was it? I think you called it TS.
Yes,
was your brand.
It's Tom Shortell. I have a whole line of Tom Shortell wines that I make at Pommenac, Reserve Selection Riesling.
But it was just a cool experience, and
Well, listen, you know, when I serve wines by the glass, the reason I do maybe 10 whites and 10 reds is because I want you to be able to bounce around. I want you to be able to listen. You may want to have a, you know, you're going to start off with some oysters, so you may want to have a Sauvignon Blanc or. Some Sylvana or something with the oysters, and then, you know, I'm going to have a steak later, you know, I want to drink that, you know, so I don't want to buy a bottle, you know, just buy a glass of this and a glass of that, and you're on your way, you know, you have a red and a white, you know, or two whites or two reds or whatever, you know.
I always find it interesting that restaurants don't sort of offer a flight of wine. To me, it's so exciting. I know that in the city at the Russian Tea Room, they're known for their flight of vodkas.
Yeah.
And here on Long Island, the Dirty Taco, they might have, I think, there might be 12 different tequilas. Some of them, are, I guess, they're interesting because they have different price points, believe.
Sure.
I believe. But again, you get, you know, I think it's like three different samples, and it just makes for a little bit of excitement, especially, you know, when you're out there with other people and, you know, you sit there and discuss the scenario.
Yeah, it makes it fun. It's fun, you know. I went into a bar I was playing a gig at with Dorio, and a bartender knew me, you know, so he's an older fella, and he says, "Hey, Tom, you know, yeah, well, can I get you a drink?" I said, "You got a wine list?" He goes, "A wine list? We're only open 2 weeks." I'm like, "Well, you have a bathroom, don't you? I mean, you know, you got a beer list? Yeah, I got a whiskey's all over the place, you know." I don't know why people fall down on a wine thing, and then they compromise and buy some rot gut that's wrong. I shouldn't have said that. Buy a lesser wine that, you know, the salesman's going to dump on you because he has to make a quota or he gets a trip to, you know, to Napa or whatever. And you wind up with this, you know, less than stellar stuff. And there's a place and that I won't go to, that I was going to for a long time because I was, you know, like playing there or whatever, watching Friends, they had live music, but it was painful. I mean, I couldn't get the wines down. It was like awful. And now there's no reason for me to go there. I mean, I wouldn't go there for dinner because for me, that's the other half. You know, I want to enjoy a bottle of wine or a couple of glasses or something. So I avoid it. And I think that they don't think about that. You know, you've thought about the beer guy. You got all kinds of craft beers. You thought about the booze guy. You got all kinds of bourbons and whiskeys and ryes, you know.
But as a restaurateur, take us through the supply chain. So a restaurant opens,
right,
gets its alcohol license,
mm-hmm,
and lo and behold, some way, somehow, the various vendors know that you're open.
Yeah.
So my understanding of the liquor industry is that there are two or three major distributors, and maybe then there's a lot of independents or whatever.
Yeah.
So how does a restaurateur figure it all out? Because it's just like in my business, selling advertising, we go out and we solicit all different businesses, and some businesses don't want to be involved,
right,
in having 100 people attack them directly about advertising, so they, mm-hmm, hire an advertising agency to sort of mind the fort and help them make the decision.
Right.
So, again, if you're being hit by 20 different vendors, and how do you figure out, again, how to build your wine list? And is it something that, you know, you do once and it's like that for 6 years, even though you probably have the purveyors, you know, coming in all the time and trying,
sure,
to sell you?
Mm-hmm.
How does it all work? Because, again, as a restaurateur, you're busy trying to, you know, figure out the food. You're trying to manage your staff. You're trying to maintain your ambiance and decor of your restaurant. You know, how much time do people put into it? And is it sometimes you just get a distributor comes in, you choose one guy, they come in and they give you the pre-printed menu and...
Yeah, well,
there you go.
It's all of the above. I mean, you know, it all depends on how much interest you have in wine. You know, if you think wine's important to your restaurant, you take some time. And when you open a place, you're going to get bombarded by different salesmen who are going to come in because that's what they do. It's what they should do. They want to sell you wine. So you get the least interested guy takes a salesman, okay, you know, make me a wine list. And then the salesman basically dumps all his stuff that he has to get rid of on that restaurant. And I can tell a dumping ground wine list just by reading it, you know what I mean? Because I know what's out there. Then you take the next interest level is the guy who thinks, you know, okay, some of the wines are important, and they want to get a couple of names on there because, you know, names sell the wine itself. Like cake bread, you know, for argument's sake, cake bread Chardonnay, you don't have to sell it. People know the name, and people are name conscious. So you get a wine list where, you know, I'll go in there, and as a customer, I'll go in there, I'm like, oh, God, I can't find anything. And, you know, okay, but they have like five Chardonnays, you know, one Pinot Grigio, two Sauvignon Blancs, and I have eight Cabernets, one Pinot Noir, one Malbec.
Obviously, depending on the depth of your list, like, do you do a, you know, a domestic and an import and things like that?
Well, it's a choice you make. I mean, there was a time in Montauk where I did an all-American list because I was an American chef in America doing American food. I just thought it was a good idea. It was a time when Allure, excuse me, had only Long Island wines. You know, I mean, I made a decision at Amano, because it's an Italian restaurant, to go half Italian, half Long Island, because that's where I was and that's what I was serving. So I think different people, you know, think differently about the lists.
It also has to be interesting to try to figure out how much inventory to keep. You know, somebody orders one bottle of wine, they're ready for their second bottle of wine, because some of the people have an empty glass, some have filled glasses.
Sure.
And I guess technically, every time you get service of a bottle, you should get a new glass, but that doesn't always happen.
Yeah, see, I prefer to have the glass with the wine already in it, because I think wine is better than soap. You know, if I have a new glass, there's a good chance that it was washed, hopefully.
Not that it's the greatest problem in life, that if you're ready to
order. No, these are first world problems.
Yeah, no. But if you're having a bottle of wine, you know you want another one, you call out to the waiter or waitress, you know, we're ready for another bottle, and they go, oops, we don't have any more. You know?
Well, that happens. I mean, you know, it's not an exact science. I mean, just going on to the levels, and, you know, then you get to the next level, and steakhouses do this all the time. And this is no knock against my friend who owns a bunch of steakhouses, but they get a list with what I call all the usual suspects, you know, all the Camus and Silver Oak and, you know, Faust and all the names that everybody knows. Yeah, and, you know, we're in a label-conscious society here on Long Island. If you go to the Americana, you know, you got, you know, Hirschfelders and Italian?
Toku and Cipriani.
No, not even that. Not the restaurants. I'm talking about even the stores.
Oh.
You know, you got Coach bags and Hermes and Prada and all that. So everybody's like label conscious. You know, you're not going to get a woman from the North Shore caught dead in a not a designer clothes, right? So, but it translates over to, the wine lists. I mean, people know what they know. I mean, I was at a party where a guy said to me, oh, wait till you taste this wine. I get this wine. It's famous and it's old. And I'm thinking, please don't make it be Camus. Please don't make it be Camus. Please don't make it be Camus. And I said, which one you got? He goes, Camus. I'm like, oh, no, you know. I just don't think it's good wine anymore. I think it's fine. It's a beverage. You can taste it. It tastes good. But there's no stuff to it, you know. It's just this formulaic California wine. Anyway, getting around that.
So here's an interesting scenario. You just took me to it. I was going to bring up that in the newspaper the other day, there was an article about power lunches filling restaurants again. And they were talking about that usually it was Tuesdays and Thursdays were the big days.
Right.
And Fridays is the best day because people go for these three-hour lunches and don't come back.
oh, no.
But I happened to be on the North Shore recently. And at one restaurant, and there's no shame in noting it, it was Toku at the Americana.
Yeah.
And we had a business event that was in the back room. And, we get there to set up at like 11 o'clock and, you know, fully staffed and ready to go. A very, very, very nice restaurant, just very professionally run.
Oh, yeah, the Paul Brothers do a great job.
By the time we left at like 1:32, the restaurant itself was full.
Hmm.
And it was mostly female.
Yeah.
And it's not the most, it's not the cheapest restaurant in town. But I found that very interesting. And then a couple of months earlier, we had been over at Bar Fritz in Greenvale.
Yeah, Greenvale
and
Center.
And it's in the Wheatley Shopping Center over there. And the same thing. It was a Thursday, a Friday afternoon. Restaurants jumping. And again, mostly women, which I guess it's just coincidental. Maybe the two areas that you know I'm talking about aren't, you know, more traditional business areas. They're more shopping areas, so that there would be more of a mix if it was in a more metropolitan area. But I was amazed because if I understand it correctly, you hear so many restaurants not serving lunch.
Yeah.
Yet these two, if it was just coincidence that when I was there that they, you know, well filled the capacity, it was just incredible to me. I just
you have a lot of money. You know, there's a wealthy area up there, you know, and, you know, a lot of the women don't work. I mean, they're kind of, you know, they're well off, and you know, they, what are you going to do? I mean, the afternoon you go to the gym or you go to, you know, yoga class, whatever, and meet for lunch. I mean, we used to see it. I was, when I had Jewel, everything was in a business community there because we had all the buildings, and we used to do 200 lunches a day. It was crazy. Now I think they're struggling for lunch over there, all the restaurants, because a lot of buildings are vacant, you know. I mean, nobody went back to work. But in, you know, in Greenvale area and Manhasset area up there, it's not the case. You don't have a lot of, you know, office buildings. You have a lot of, you know, commercial stuff. I mean, people, but you also have a lot of, you know, a thickly dense population over there with, you know, who, with a lot of the women don't work, you know.
No, and what's interesting, and I don't want our listeners to get the wrong opinion of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great that in those communities that there's a lot of women that are able to either have part-time jobs, and because of responsibilities to the children and the family or whatever. So it seems to be just, again, an interesting scenario that may or may not be typical across the island. But again, it was just, I just hear so many times that if a restaurant could only do some lunch business, that it would be really hitting its numbers, because to get Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and maybe Sunday if you're doing business, well, that's expected.
Yeah.
But if you can, you know, cut your overhead by having income, you know, for lunch.
Yeah, you're paying rent for lunch. You might as well, you know, I mean, if you can fill it, great. You know, I want to double back to something, too, that Val brought up. And she said, you know, can I ask you a question about this wine thing? She goes, so, okay, here you have a wine that's $72 a glass, right? And so let's say that's $400 a bottle or $500 a bottle. Are you expected to tip 20% on that bottle? Because a $50 bottle of wine would, let's say, get you a $10 tip, right? You're doing the same work. You're opening the wine, you're pouring a glass.
I'm going to take you to task a little deeper on that. Because I understand what you're saying, if you order something less expensive, more expensive.
Yeah.
But I always hear people grumbling and mumbling about you don't give the same level of tip for the food portion of your bill as compared to your beverage part. So, like, if you have a $400 bill for four to six people or whatever, and of that, half of it is alcohol and half is the food, what do? I usually, if it's right or wrong, I usually take the tax here in New York, double it, and that's the tip.
Right.
Round it up, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But some people say, you know, again, they won't do that because they said, you know, so much of it was, you know, just bar service.
Yeah, but you see, I think that's, you know, what's the word? Thrifty. I think that's being thrifty. I think that, you know, you get a restaurant check, a normal amount of drinks and a normal food, fine. You pay that, and you whatever tip you think is appropriate, you know, 12, 15, 18, 20, 30%, whatever you do is fine. But now the difference between, like I said, my wine bill was, I paid for the wine, right? Mm-hmm. So my wine bill was probably around $700. So do you tip, you know, do I give them a $140 tip? All they did was bring a couple of glasses over and open a bottle.
But deep, did delving deep into it, it's not necessarily your waiter or waitress that you're tipping, because I assume there's some sharing with the bartender.
There is, but I think that point is immaterial, because it just comes down to a question of, if I ordered a $50 bottle of Chardonnay, you know, that's roughly a $10 tip at 20%, let's say, right? Now they come over, they open it up, they put the glasses down, they pour it, you smell it, whatever, they put it down, they pour, they put it on a thing, they come by, they fill your glass every once in a while when it's getting low. That's the extent of it, right? It's the same thing for an $800 bottle.
There's so
same
much,
amount of labor.
There's so much thought that goes into this, because in the concert business, for ticket sales, many times there's a 10% fee on up to a $100 ticket,
right,
and it goes from there to a more expensive ticket.
Yeah,
they actually, it's less of a service fee.
Yeah.
So there's so you can really get yourself crazy with this discussion.
You can, and well, so my opinion on this is that I think that once you cross a threshold, a financial threshold with wine and or, let's say, even cognac. I mean, there are cognacs, you know, Louis XIII, I saw it was $200 an ounce. So if she pours you or brings you, let's say, 2 ounces, that's $400. Are you required to give her $100 for, you know, bringing a drink from the bar to the thing? I think, my opinion, I've done both. You know, I've done the 25% thing, and I've done the, you know what, I'm just going to use my judgment here. And I think that's allowed. I don't think that there's any hard, fast rule with that. I think if you want a tip on the entire thing, and, you know, there's a school of thought that says, well, if you have enough money to buy the wine, you should have enough money for the tip. Yeah, okay, that's probably the waiter's point of view. But the other, you know, the customer's point of view is, you know, just because I, you know, have enough money doesn't mean that I have to fund your child's education. You know what I mean? So it's like, I think at that point it should be left to the customer. You
well,
know?
It's interesting you say that. So, again, I went to this family party at a local restaurant, and it was a buffet. And I saw one of the guests at the end of the brunch go over to one of the service people, and this was a brunch, and give him a tip. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it's nice.
And then we had an event out east with Jeffrey Wands. He's a local, reads people's, talks to the people in the psychic, excuse me.
Oh.
I couldn't figure out.
Talks to dead people.
Talks to dead people.
Yeah.
But there was like 60 people in a room, and it was a buffet service, but there was some service people walking around. And one of the women went over to the essentially busboy, because again it was a buffet, mm-hmm, and gave him some money. And first of all, the worker was like, wow, thank you so much, you know, he just lit up.
Sure.
And I went over to the woman afterwards, and I said, you know what, you made that guy's night. You know, he's here collecting a salary or whatever, and you didn't have to do what you did, but you did. And he'll go home and he'll remember that somebody recognized his,
sure,
attentiveness, and I think that's pretty cool. Again, when you get without expectation is truly the best. We talk about this all the time, where somebody has a problem with something in a restaurant and they demand some sort of betterment. And
yeah, a reward.
A reward. And at the same time, if something happens or whatever, and they decide to bring out a dessert or this or that, it's just really, to me, it takes it to another level, and I'm so appreciative. I that's just me.
Yeah, you know, I think, and I've said this before, I think 110% is the minimum requirement for restaurants every night that they're open. And it's the only business that I've seen do that. I mean, if you go into a hardware store and they're out of nails, you go, all right, you know, whatever, no, sorry. You don't go, okay, what are you going to do for me? Do I get 6 extra screws? Are you going to hand me a toaster? You know, it's like, that never happens in any other business, you know? You know, I bought a watch one time, I never wear them. I bought this watch, and it didn't work from day one, you know. So I brought it back. The guy fixed it. It didn't work. I brought it back again. The guy fixed it. And it was fine. But I didn't go, well, listen, you're going to compensate me for my gas coming back and forth, and, you know, how about a free diamond ring? Or, you know, can I get a cross with a chain on it? It's nuts,
so,
you know.
So here's a great story. It's sort of in line. For the radio station, I do a lot of events with clients, and I ordered something for an event that was happening. And I went on Amazon. There was the same product was available through different vendors.
Yeah.
At least that's the way I interpreted it. And I needed it for Sunday. So there was somebody that said they could deliver by Friday. I thought that was great. So I ordered it.
Got a cushion there on Saturday.
Yeah. Right. So I order it. Then somehow, some way, late on Friday, I get an email saying your shipment will arrive before 10 o'clock
July.
At night. So that wasn't too good because the shipment was like $300 item.
Yeah.
And what were they going to do with it? And we find that sometimes when we order things on Amazon, being in a strip mall, they leave it outside by the door.
Yeah,
this is a shopping center.
Yeah.
It's not somebody's porch where you got to deal with, porch pirates, I guess they call them.
Yeah.
So I was concerned. I looked at it. There was an ability to make a comment or leave a note, instructions. So I said, it has to be delivered to the second floor outside our door. So, I figured, okay, it's Friday night. I'll before I go home, I'll just shoot over and bring it in. Then I get an email on Saturday, and I neglected to go get the package Friday night. Saturday I get an email. Your package was delivered on Monday.
Wow.
So that didn't.
Yeah.
Really.
Thanks a lot.
Sit well with me. So. Somebody said, why don't you call Amazon and complain? So I attempted. Now, trying to find a phone number
person,
for Amazon was not the easiest thing.
I know, it's terrible.
But I found it. And I called, and somebody, went through it with me, and I said, I need this for Sunday. Now I'm getting it Monday. I ordered it on Wednesday. I would have gone through different strategies to be able to satisfy my need.
Sure.
So I said, now, I'm in a hole. So he said, well, we have a program where we can help you. Now, I keep hearing all these stories in life today. Your TV doesn't work. They say, put it in the garbage. We're going to send you another one because you had a warranty.
All these crazy things.
I really wasn't looking to pounce on anybody, but it just seemed I was wronged.
Yeah, sure.
But it gets worse. I forgot all about Monday. And Tuesday, the shipment arrives. And I go, wow, this is crazy. But the person had said about this program, and you call up once you get it, and they had sent me a text, and I had to accept it. I call up, and it's similar to this thing where I used to fly a lot of Spirit Airlines, and they'd always have problems. And the person on the phone would always go, oh, we're so sorry for your interfering with your plans.
I didn't realize you wanted a seat.
And I would be like cursing. I mean, I was just losing it. And the person would say, we're so sorry,
but
may your life be good.
Yeah,
so
peace be with you.
It was the same thing. So at any rate, I call up on, I guess this was on my way home Tuesday night, and I call up and I said, the customer service person from Saturday had said he noted my record.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, it's nice to have it noted.
So the person gets on, and I go through everything, and can you hold on this, that, and the other? And, it's the same thing. We're so sorry. I said, well, I heard there's this program where they compensate you. Let me put you on hold, please. It will probably be 2 or 3 minutes.
The program
director.
Okay.
And the man comes back and he goes, sorry, this program doesn't relate to you. So it became a matter of principle at that point. So I said I wanted to speak to a supervisor, because obviously he had spoken to a supervisor, but they don't even speak to supervisor; they text.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They go, I sent a chat. So somebody gets on, and I explain my circumstances. And the woman was just very on the mark. I mean, she took control of the situation. I wasn't being obnoxious, but I just thought I was wrong. And she goes, I'm looking into it, you know, and she started asking questions. Well, was it somebody with a foreign accent that you spoke with?
Of course it was.
I mean, it was bizarre, because, yes, that's like the norm.
Yeah.
She goes, because we use phone centers across the world.
Bombay. You know? Yeah.
So she goes, but I'm really getting upset myself, because I don't see any notation of anything that you've said, and they have ways of skirting around things so there can't be follow-up or whatever.
Yeah.
She goes, but the bottom line is, you didn't pay for the shipping on this item. We did, so there's nothing we can
do.
Good luck, yeah. I said, well, that's funny, because I don't know how the Amazon system works, but it said free shipping, so that's why. And the right date, so that's why I chose that.
Yeah.
She goes, no, if you were paying for the freight, we would have credited you the freight or something.
Yeah.
And she goes, just so you know, the program that this person was telling you about, we give you $5 off.
There you go.
You know, and it's something you have to, when you purchase something online that actually is sold by Amazon and serviced by Amazon. I'm going, oh my goodness. I said, I can't explain how violated I felt.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the follow-up on the service call was worth, again, I don't bill by the hour, but still, I was probably on the phone for an hour with all this nonsense.
It's torture.
But the woman was so good at handling the dispute, I said, I don't even want the $5. She goes, no, we have to give it to you at this point.
I insist.
So, but she, again, she calmed, she put out the fire, you know, life goes on.
Well, that's really what you want is acknowledgement. I mean, to bring it back to food, I was in a restaurant a couple of weeks ago and I ordered foie gras, you know. And the foie gras came and it had some kind of a cranberry, a little out of season, but it had a little cranberry relish on it, you know. And so I taste the foie gras and it's refrigerator cold, it's ice cold, you know. I'm thinking, why did I just get the cranberry relish or whatever? So I move the relish off and I take another piece of the foie gras and it's kind of like icy inside almost, you know. So I call this kid over, he's like, you know, the waiter, he's like 12 years old, you know. He comes over and I said, listen, is everything okay? I'm like, well, not really. What's the problem? I said, the foie gras is really cold. It's an open kitchen, you know, so I'm sitting right there. And so he goes over to the cook and they're whispering, you know, back and forth. And I'm getting the side glances from the cook or whatever. And that was it. Nobody ever said anything. Can I get you another? Can I warm it up for you? We got to take it off the bill. Can I, you know, get you a condo in Maui or whatever? Nothing, you know.
So let me ask you
this. And so I thought it was going to be off the bill, you know. I thought I was going to take it off the bill, you know. No, it was on the bill when I left. So I paid it and said, you know, I know the owner. I'll talk to him about it, you know, at some point.
So I have foie gras. Is it in the kitchen? Somebody hands in a ticket for a portion of foie gras.
Right.
Is that something that's prepared already, and then it's sautéed, or is it sautéed?
No, it's sliced already, but then it's sautéed.
And then
unless you're making a terrine, which is a cold thing, and that's already prepared.
So, like when you described the scenario you just did, that was just like all bad.
Totally. Totally. It was terrible. And it was $35, too. You know what I mean? So they're getting top dollar for it. So and I don't mind that. You know what I mean? I know what it costs.
Foie gras should always come warm.
Well, unless you're making a terrine. I mean, there are cold preparations of foie gras. But, you know, it should be warm in the center. It should be a little medium rareish and warm in the center. You know, you can overcook it, and then it becomes just like a piece of, you know, calf's liver.
It looks like, is it look more like chicken liver?
Yeah, you cut it into sizes like that. I mean, foie gras is big. It's, you know, the size of both of your hands, really. But, it was really cold in the center. I was like, come on, dude. You know, this is like raw here, you know. Give me a break.
So how did you deal with that? So you made the comment.
Yeah.
You went back to the chef. You know, you saw him talking.
Yeah.
And then did they take away your foie gras?
No. No, there was never another.
And did you eat it?
No, I pushed it to the side. I didn't eat it.
So then, And you said that you just let it lay, and we're going to deal with it separately.
Yeah, you know, it's about training your staff. I mean, I blame really the ownership rather than the kid. I mean, he's a kid. He's inexperienced. He's, you know, he's dealing with an adult, which is always hard for a kid who's 20, 21, you know. and, you know, he should have been trained to say, listen, you know, can I get you something else? Can I get you another one? Can I warm it up for you? Can I take it off? I mean, you know, just give me a couple options here, you know. And like I said, and it was still on the bill when I left. I was looking, I started laughing. I'm like, you know, it's still here because, you know, she was saying he's probably going to take it off the bill. I said, I don't know, you know. Didn't seem like they were ready to deal with it, you know. And I think they were just, you know, somewhat afraid and, you know, timid or whatever and somewhat ignorant about what to do.
Yeah, but sometimes things are arbitrary, you know. I can't begin to tell you how many times somebody says... I'm laughing because I know you're going to really get a kick out of it. You know, this fish dish is too fishy or the salad is too salty. Did you put salt on my salad?
Oh, please. You know?
So those things are arbitrary.
Yeah, yeah.
But as you just described your foie gras experience, that was just all wrong.
The whole thing was wrong. Look, restaurants make mistakes. I mean, you know, it's not a perfect, you know, you're at the mercy of your employees, and, you know, they can blow it. Somebody's having a bad day. They're getting divorced, fighting with the children, whatever. I mean, things happen in life. And I find that as I'm in my 50th year in the restaurant business, you know, people are just way more impatient than they used to be, way nastier than they used to be. You know, you used to go to a restaurant, you open a menu, you find some money, you order, you go home. Now it's a big, you know, it's a 15-minute dissertation on allergies and phobias and all this other stuff, and you know, a restaurant menu is a mere suggestion at this point. You know?
I know you're already putting on your jacket. You're ready to leave the studio because we're running out of time here. But I have to refer back to my favorite TV program, Below Deck, and the chef was faced with a list of menu restrictions from the six guests. One didn't like vegetables.
Yeah.
One was this. One was that. And it was just impossible to keep up. And when they plan the dinner, it's planned in advance so he can figure it out.
Yeah.
But breakfast is sort of as it comes. So, you know, I'll have this omelet. I'll have this. I'll have that. And then he has to understand what the dietary restrictions. I don't know how they pull it off.
Yeah, no, I'm a chef, not a pharmacist, you know. I mean, the bottom line is, I mean, I did an omakase dinner the other night, you know, and yet this people don't like, this one doesn't like fish, he can't eat tuna, he doesn't like, you know, the hot sauce on the other. Why are you coming to a dinner like this if you have all of these needs, you know? This isn't the dinner for you.
But that being said, it's funny, going back to the Toku event we did, they're known for their sticky rice, I think they call it.
Yeah.
And it's like a cube of sticky rice.
Yeah.
And normally it comes with like a salmon on top, ground salmon.
Yeah.
But for some people that don't like fish, they have a vegetarian version, which is guacamole on top, which is well done.
Yeah.
It's actually very cool. So sometimes it's easily remedied, but again...
All I'll say on that thing is if you know, we understand that people have issues, you know, and we always try to accommodate them, but if... You know, Saturday night at 8 o'clock is not the time to play Rachel Ray with your meal. You know what I mean? If you want to do that, come in on Tuesdays and we'll all have some fun with it when it's not that busy.
No, and it takes sometimes a little bit of the wait staff supporting the chef. And I know we ordered something at the restaurant the other night and Kerry asked about something being not included in the assortment. And they said, well, it's like already prepared, whatever it was.
It
wasn't something that shouldn't have been.
Yeah, couldn't take it out of the sauce or whatever.
The waiter explained it, we accepted it, and we moved on.
No, that's it. I mean, you know, and I want everybody to remember, too, when you start, you know, twisting around your dinner, you're taking time away from somebody else's. And that's the only thing that, you know, that really bothers me is if I have to spend an extra time, five minutes, 6 minutes on yours, that's another 6 minutes that somebody else isn't waiting. And with that, we're going to close the show with Tom's Three Keys to Life, which is life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last and keep chocolate in your life is as important as sex and pizza. Wish everybody a happy and healthy Passover, and we'll see you next week.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.